My name is Deanne Lagerquist. I'm a member of the faculty at St. Olaf College, specifically in the prayer college and the religion department, and I'm trained as a church historian, which is the sort of thing which if you say it at a cocktail party or something, people sort of go and look for more dip. Two in 2 days. Not here, so we just sit calmly and go on with our own business, and the tape has a funny sound in the background. Okay. All right, well, we'll go on. So what I was saying about history is that I think it's really the way we look for patterns, and so the questions we have help us see patterns in the past. And if we have a particular lens, like this tree of life image, that also helps us. So what I want to do today is, first of all, talk a little bit about the theme of the tree of life. And then we'll look at a couple biblical stories to help us think about hospitality. And I hope we'll have time very briefly to look at two examples from the 19th and 20th century of hospitality before I make summary comments. So that sounds like about 3 days worth of work, and we'll see how it goes. So first of all, the theme of the tree of life. Since I'm charged with the theme, I think I need to say something about that each time. We won't go through the same exercise that we did last time, but I do want to remind you that this is a metaphor that draws on rich references in our scripture, that evokes from our own experiences with trees, and that also connects with other traditions. Not just Christianity has these images of sacred trees. One of the very exciting things about the tree of life image, and I think one of the reasons it's becoming so popular, that you'll see it a lot when you leave here. It won't just be because suddenly you're aware of it, but it will also be because it's being used more and more. One of the reasons for that, I think, and I'm always doing this in class, pointing to what used to be here. In Anne's session, she has these three different ways of understanding the relationship between God and the world. And over here was this kind of pyramid structure with the, now I'm going to what Gail Ramshaw writes about, the metaphor of the crown that draws on monarchy as a primary way to organize our understanding of the world, of our relationship to God, and our relationship to each other. And as Anne said, all of these things can operate simultaneously, but there are dangers in any one by itself. The danger of this sort of pyramid myth of the crown is that it can become very static, and it does kind of encourage us to see winners and losers always. And the tree of life gives us a very different, here, even, you know, if you just look at the way a tree looks, the geometric thing is very, very different. Now, of course, a pyramid is really stable, and we've had a wet spring in Minnesota. We know that trees aren't always really stable. Sometimes they just bend right over. But this is an organic metaphor. It's a metaphor that emphasizes some different aspects of our relationship with God. It emphasizes nurture, shelter, and beauty, while it also incorporates our experiences of danger and death. So it's a very rich, rich metaphor. And that incorporation of death, of course, most centrally with the reference to the cross. If you didn't notice yesterday, please do notice when you go in the village center this spectacular crucifix that a friend of the village up in Stehekin carved for us, the Tree of Life crucifix. Again, he's drawing on a rich and old tradition of portraying Jesus and the cross as the tree of life, or sometimes as the vineyard, so that Jesus on the cross is the vine that's being pressed into the wine at the Eucharistic table. Gail Ramshaw is one of the people who from whom I have learned about the Tree of Life. She's fascinated by it. It shows up in a lot of her work, in this autobiographical piece, Under the Tree of Life, which you can get in the bookstore. But what I want to start with today is from this little alphabet book, which is now available from a different publisher under the name The Metaphorical God. And this is her entry for tea. So just sit back and listen, and we'll also listen to those two Bible stories to give us the rich ground that we'll then think out of. So I'll try and read in an appealing and lively way. It's about three pages, short pages long. Tea, God's grove of trees. The tree of life set in Eden, the tree from which we have not yet tasted. But an old legend says that Seth took a seed from the sacred tree and planted it in the grave of Father Adam's mouth. From that seed grew a towering tree around which hovered healing powers. From that tree was built a wooden bridge over the waters at Siloam, and there the Queen of Sheba prophesied a coming glory. From that ramshackle bridge's scrap lumber was finally constructed a cross, which, when exhumed by pious Helena, restored a dead man to life, the true cross. Was the tree a gopher tree, lumber for Noah's ark? Was this tree of life a tamarisk tree or an oak, which along with Sarah's tomb was all Abraham owned in the promised land? Was this tree of life a palm tree, shading wise Deborah as she judged God's people Israel? Was the tree a cedar, becoming one of the walls of God's house, the temple of Jerusalem? Or perhaps the cypress used for the sanctified floor? Was it perhaps the broom tree under which rested Elijah before he walked up to the mountain of God? Was the tree an apple tree, hovering over the lover, she singing a canticle, his upraised trunk spilling over and filling his love with fruit? And what kind of tree was Jesse's tree, appearing dried up, but sheltering a stump, now a twig, now a branch, and finally a tree of life? Was Jesse's tree the fig tree, under which Nathanael sat, only to be found and named by the Messiah? Was Jesse's tree the sycamore, up which half-pint Zacchaeus would climb to catch a glimpse of God? Perhaps the tree is the olive tree of God's people, into which we broken branches are grafted. So she really gives us this lovely, fast hike, identifying all the trees of the scripture, although we probably could find some more. Most likely the tree is all of these: gopher, tamarisk, palm, cedar, cypress, broom, apple and fig, sycamore and olive, and yet two more. For the tree in the city of God at the end of time grows 12 different fruits, and its leaves are for the healing of the nations, a sacred woodland from a single trunk. Over my desk hangs a reproduction of Hannah Kunin's Tree of Life. Hannah Kunin, who showed up one day with her two children — no record was found of her marriage, the museum plaque found it necessary to say — in Hancock, Massachusetts, joined the Shaker community there and is known to us today by name, as precious few Shakers are, because she painted religious symbols. And this was during the period of Mother Ann's work, those of you who were with me last time. Hannah's drawings are art. This picture, a mighty tree with checkered leaves and fruit round and full, greens and orange and gold, like sunflowers, the leaves and fruits far too large for the slender trunk, but somehow perfectly balanced in holy air. The Shakers revered the Tree of Life, which they, the elect, would enjoy, not now, but someday. At the Fisk Museum are some unpublished drawings for Pilgrim's Progress by William Blake. And while we bemoan all those bearded old men that Blake drew for God, we are struck silent by his depiction of the Tree of Life sheltering the pilgrim Christian on his journey. For it is clearly a tree, roots, trunk, branches, leaves, and fruit. But this Tree of Life illustrates a passage in which Christian has this vision of the cross. For so it has been in Christian symbolism that the bountiful tree and the dead tree are one. That the tree of God is both paradise and Calvary. In Acts, Peter already said that he was hanged on a tree, And so Simone Veil writes of living naked and nailed to the tree of life. The tree of our God is the cross, our Yggdrasil, the mythic Norse ash tree, binding earth and heaven and hell, is the crucifix. Bonaventure's tree of life makes the branches of the great tree the truth of the mystery of Christ. Yet the cross becomes one not only with the tree of life, but also with the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that tree which in confirming the humanity of Eve and Adam gave them death. Did John at the foot of the cross catch sight of the serpent slithering in the shadow of the taboo cross piece? For on Passion Sunday, we affirm that the one who by a tree overcame may by a tree be overcome. As the tree is Christ, so we become trees. And then she quotes from Psalm 92, "The righteous shall flourish like a palm tree and shall spread abroad like the cedar of Lebanon. Those who are planted in the house of the Lord shall flourish in the courts of our God. They shall bear fruit in old age. They shall be green and succulent." But the tree is Christ, so the tree is God. It is the Lord who watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The Lord shall preserve you from all evil. The Lord shall keep you safe. Psalm 121. So we have this sort of in our back of our mind, all the kinds of things that the tree is about. And today we want to look particularly at the fruit that we bear when we are the tree, even as we think about the way that we bear that fruit living under the tree. Okay? So it's symbols are like that. They shape shift. And it's hard for very literal-minded modern Americans whose way of thinking is so shaped by the digital 0, 1, 1, 0. Everything is yes, no, on, off, to think that way. But the Tree of Life image pushes us to let things kind of flow and shift around. Okay, so the fruit that we're going to talk about today is hospitality. And this is not one of the fruits that appears in any of Paul's lists of the fruits of the Spirit, although clearly it is, maybe it's a pie you make with the fruits of the Spirit. I can go a little wild with this, but it certainly partakes of those fruits that Paul writes about, like peace, kindness, generosity, self-control. Okay, so I want you to just take a couple minutes and to think about a time when you have received hospitality, okay? When you have been the one who has been welcomed. And just let yourself go back to that experience and remember what you needed and how you got it and what it was like. Okay, everybody have one kind of in mind. I'd like to hear just a couple people tell experiences of being welcomed, receiving hospitality. Who is willing to do that?
I have an unusual one.
I'll okay.
We were stranded in San Diego. We had driven too late at night because we thought we could just take a budget tell or something. We were flying out 6 o'clock the next morning. And, we spent hours, 3 hours. 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, could not find a place to stay.
All been there.
So we thought, well, we'll have to pull into where we had rented a car, and all those glaring lights were there where we were. So I said, let's just take one more run by the University of San Diego. Usually there's an inner visitor place. So there wasn't, and I just couldn't dare stand to feet because my husband, he just thinks I have these crazy ideas anyway. So I said, well, I know, one more thing. Couple of friend of ours who are here happened to be named Young, and I said, their son, Tim Young, is here in San Diego. I'll look him up in the phone book and call him. And of course, as soon as I got to the phone book, he was not listed.
Oh.
But there was a Tim and Mary Young. Well, he wasn't married. But nevertheless, I called Tim and Mary Young. And I was waiting in the car, and I was dying to be successful at something. And it's cold by now, it's almost midnight. So Mary Young answers the phone, And I said, I'm looking for Tim Young from Madison, Wisconsin. She said, oh, sorry. No, it's not the one. But ha, ha, ha. Would you believe though I grew up in Milwaukee? And I said, oh, my husband did too. So we developed this conversation. He ended up sleeping. We found their house in all of San Diego. We wound up way around the hill. And when we got there, she had a bed made on the floor and one on the couch. She left breakfast out in the kitchen and nice towels. They had to go off to work the next morning.
Oh my goodness.
And here we came in the dark and the dogs were there and all that, but we had a bed to sleep.
That's a great story. Somebody else want to tell a story about receiving hospitality? Well, I have... go ahead, yeah.
I remembered this happening this summer. I must have been a very small child, you know, 4 or 5, maybe possibly 6. And the family had been up on the north shore of the Lake Superior. And remember what cars were like about that time, 1936. And we started up that big hill from Duluth,
yeah.
Up and up and up and up and up. And the car conked out. But just ahead of us was a filling station, and behind it, a house where people lived. And, well, Dad was getting the car taken care of. The woman of the house came out, and very concerned about my mother and the baby and so on, invited us to stay overnight mm-hmm. with them.
I once got stranded in Chicago in Midway Airport, standing in line just as they canceled my flight in a blizzard. Now, because I'd lived in Chicago, I thought, no sweat. So I just got in a taxi, went to Hyde Park, went in a restaurant, and started to call. I started with the A, so I called Herb and Phyllis Anderson, and Phyllis said, oh, we're just making waffles. I'll come and get you. Now, if I had planned to stay in Hyde Park, I don't know that I would have called them. And I certainly wouldn't have called some of the people on my list. You know, I thought, well, I could get down to Mark Pearson, whose father teaches with me, who lives in I House. It would be kind of weird, but in the circumstances, I could do it. One of the interesting things that happened, however, is that the next time I came to Chicago, I did plan to stay with the Andersons. And until they moved to Seattle, every time I went to Chicago, I went and stayed with the Andersons. Very different than what I would have expected if I just shown up at a hotel that night with no reservation in the middle of a blizzard, right? Although I now have to, I've used this story before, I now have to adapt the story or give a caveat, because when I was coming up to Holden, I was to stay at a place in Chelan, and when I arrived, they said, oh, we're so sorry, you were no-show last night. And I guess my having worked in registration at Holden helped, because I must have had just the right demeanor. And we talked, and they said, but we do have this one room behind the desk, you know, where they keep all their stuff, and they moved everything out and let me in. So I can't just say, oh, well, of course, in a Ramada Inn, they would never do anything for you. But we do have this expectation that in the commercial world, you don't get that kind of response. Let's listen to two biblical stories of hospitality. If you'd first read the Genesis one and then Luke right after.
The Lord appeared to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre,
mm-hmm.
as he sat at the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day. He looked up and saw three men standing near him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent entrance to meet them and bowed down to the ground. He said, my Lord, if I find favor with you, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. Let me bring a little bread that you may refresh yourselves, and after that you may pass on, since you have come to your servant. So they said, "Do as you have said." And Abraham hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, "Make ready quickly 3 measures of choice flour, knead it, and make cakes." Abraham ran to the herd and took a cow, tender and good, and gave it to his servant, who hastened to prepare it. Then he took curds and milk and the calf that he had prepared and set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree while they ate. They said to him, "Where is your wife Sarah?" And he said, "There, in the tent." Then one said, "I will surely return to you in due season, and your wife Sarah shall have a son." And Sarah was listening at the tent entrance behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old and advanced in age. It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I have grown old and my husband is old, shall I have pleasure?" The Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh and say, 'Shall I indeed bear a child now that I am old? Is anything too wonderful for the Lord?' At the set time, I will return to you in due season."
Okay. Well, I think maybe we will just remind ourselves of the story of Zacchaeus rather than read through those verses. Remember that Jesus is coming through the city, and Zacchaeus, who is probably a tax collector, or maybe I read someone recently said it, probably he was a toll collector, and not particularly well-liked and not known for being particularly honest, wants to see Jesus, and he climbs up in the tree so that he can look down, and Jesus sees him. Now, last time when we talked about people's childhood or other memories of trees, somebody talked about climbing up in the tree and how it can sort of shelter you, it can hide you. Generally, we don't think that someone is going to see us when we're up in the tree, but that's what happens to Zacchaeus. And Jesus, what I think seems sort of uniquely of things, he says, commands him, "Come down, I'm coming to your house." And Zacchaeus offers them that hospitality of his house and is changed by the encounter. These two biblical stories, the first of Abraham and the second of Zacchaeus, point to a very important thing about hospitality, namely that it's something in which we start out, "I am the host, you are the guest, you are the guest, I am the host." But in the course of the transaction, there's a transformation that takes place, so that I would expect if these people who had taken me in out of the storm came to where I was, that I would welcome them now in my home, not in an extraordinary circumstance, but in an ordinary circumstance. And we don't know the end of this story about San Diego, but you know, if Mary Young came to Madison, maybe the favor was returned. Although it's not simply this kind of, it's not just a flip-flop. Right? It's not that the people who were poor get to be rich and the people who are rich get to be poor, that kind of making the high places low that we hear in the Magnificat. It's something else that I think is well represented as taking place under a tree. It's a kind of transaction, and trees figure in both of these stories, which is why I picked them, although the Abraham story is a favorite one of artists. And here's just a Rembrandt etching. I'll pass that around if you want to see. These people who took me in Chicago actually have a collection of Abraham entertaining the angels. That's a theme in their art collection. Abraham has come to stand as a model of hospitality because of that interaction that took place. In this book that was our theme book last summer, Practicing Our Faith, there's a chapter on hospitality. And there they use the posada as the example the primary example. I hope you know that Hispanic tradition of acting out the nativity story with going from door to door seeking a place for Mary and Joseph to come in. And no, 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 until finally somebody lets them in. Those stories, I think, really encourage us who have a great deal to be generous with what we have, to be hospitable, to open ourselves to others. But you notice I didn't ask you to start by thinking about when you were hospitable, rather when you received hospitality. And this is important, I think, because if we distinguish generic hospitality from hospitality that springs out of our experience with the tree of life, which is the cross, we begin at a different place, not with what we have, but rather with what we have received. Okay? This happens. So moving then along, the term that's used in Greek and Latin, both of those terms have this kind of double meaning, that the stranger is transformed in hospitality. It happens usually because some kind of a gift, what one author calls numinous reciprocity. In Abraham's case, it's that promise of the son, okay, that changes who Abraham is. And it doesn't happen instantaneously, certainly, as Sarah's reaction makes clear. It's not immediate that they are made different, but it changes everything about Abraham and Sarah. It makes them not just two people living in a foreign place, but it makes them into the forebearers of a great nation. With Zacchaeus, too, Abraham, of course, is sitting under the oaks, so that's my little tiny reference to the trees. With Zacchaeus, it climbs up in the tree, and instead of the promise of a son, it is the son who comes to him, and he is transformed. We find this also in Paul. Although Paul doesn't use hospitality, there is that same dynamic in a lot of Paul's epistles when he talks or writes about, while we were yet enemies of God, Christ died for us. That's really the dynamic of hospitality, that the one who was an enemy is made into a guest, and then the relationship is changed. As we who were enemies of God receive Christ's death on our behalf, it has ramifications. It doesn't just stay with us, but breaks down, as Paul writes, the dividing walls of hostility between everyone, so that there's this motion that takes place. Now, if we add into that tree of life image, the banquet, I think we get the messianic banquet that we sang about on Jubilee. We get a very rich and evocative image of what it means to live the way of life, to live as the people of God. So that if you think about this Eucharistic banquet as a huge picnic under the tree, right? Now that's the Eucharistic banquet, the Messianic banquet, certainly can take place in this crown monarchy business, but you have a single host who determines who comes and who doesn't. But this Messianic banquet under the tree sounds to me a lot more like a block party potluck, right? Where everybody brings something, and everybody is welcome, and everybody has plenty to eat. And probably you learn to like something you didn't know you liked.
And the tree is round,
yeah.
So the communion table itself can stretch, yep, all the way around.
Yep.
And nobody cannot fit in.
Yep, exactly. So let me make a few more comments here about how I understand distinctly Christian hospitality. Hospitality, first of all, whether it's distinctly Christian or not, overcomes a very common human impulse of hostility and suspicion toward what is unknown or foreign or strange or unfamiliar. We assume that those things are dangerous. And certainly, you know, people always remark about Holden, oh, it's so wonderful, you know, it's safe for your children. And in my heart, I always say, we hope it's safe. You know, I think, I hope it's safe. There are bears, there's a river, and there are 400 people I don't know, right? But that the hospitality is to make ourselves welcoming to what is potentially dangerous, strange, and unfamiliar. Now, we can do that in part out of practical wisdom, and that's certainly something we see in the Old Testament practice. If you look instead of at Abraham, at Hagar, when she's cast out into the desert with a skin of water, right? The desert is a dangerous place to be alone. And so there was a utility in this law of hospitality where the danger of the elements overcame human fear because it could be me next time. And I know I act out of this. There was one year we were going down the lake. There were these two Gustavus students who got on the boat not knowing how they would get to Coeur d'Alene. They'd made these piteous announcements, of course, and nobody said, oh, yeah, we're happy to take two huge college students and their packs. So we're on the boat, and finally I said to my husband, I think we bet, can we tie stuff on the top? Can we make room? Because we have stuff for three people for the whole summer. It's really full. Because I said, someday Thomas is going to need a ride because he will do this, right? And it's that reciprocity. That's not really what I think Christian hospitality is about. But because what Jesus admonishes us to do is to invite those who can't return the gesture. It's not about reciprocity, even though that may come, but it's not the motive. Hospitality is something other than taking turns entertaining the same old crowd, right? Which is, I think, all of our temptation to say, oh, I'm very hospitable. I give a lot of dinner parties, right? Well, I invite people I know and like. That's not quite what this hospitality is about. And I think also our tradition intensifies the awareness of potential need. There is that in utility, potential need. But our tradition of rooting hospitality in Christianity makes us even more aware of our need because we realize that good status, safety, even life comes from God. It's not I who have those things. I haven't gotten them for myself. It can make us generous to realize it doesn't belong to me. My need, I don't give out now out of my security. I give out of a common need that we all depend on God. This cycle of hospitality begins when enemies are transformed by Jesus' action into guests. And then we imitate that host by our hospitality to others. So that one writer says, as we were sought out when lost, we are to see others as the one for whom Christ left the 99, or even as Christ himself. Another writer in a special issue of the periodical Weavings then goes on to bring us even more to the heart of Christianity when he writes, the church as the body of Christ offers the word of life to the world. Each week we tell the story of salvation. We are the hosts who extend the love of God to all who come into God's house. We set the table for the banquet in which Christ is the ultimate host, and all who come receive their life's blood and bread at his hands. Christ provides the nourishment, but our work is to prepare the house and to welcome every guest. So then we're reminded that there's something distinct that we have to offer as Christians. That we offer, there's a kind of hospitality in which you offer what is your best. Right? There's another kind where you offer what people need. In this case, we think they come together, right? That the best we have to offer is Christ given for us. And we truly believe that this is what people need. Now, having said that, please remember that I didn't start there. Because I don't want to limit Christian hospitality to inviting people to worship. Right? There is more, even as the one who is the host at the Eucharistic table gives us more than that. But this is the center. So I would want to emphasize that Christian hospitality is not concerned only about what only Christians have to offer. But it certainly includes what we only we have to offer. Okay, so two quick incidents from relatively recent history that I think give us wonderful opportunities to think about how this might happen, not just individually, but on a large scale. And the first is the Underground Railroad. I think I find this as a wonderfully evocative example from our history, our American history of hospitality. And I'm sure all of you know more or less what happened, that there were people who were convinced that slavery was against God's will. Now, they were convinced for various reasons. That's important to point out. Not all were convinced out of Christian conviction, although many were, and particularly those who were members of the Society of Friends, the Quakers, for whom a very central teaching is that the light of God is in all human beings. This conviction motivated people whose status in society varied very much from secure to quite precarious to make their situations less stable by giving refuge to fugitives from slavery who were on their way to the promise of freedom. Now, the parallels to the Hebrew Exodus, of course, were not lost to those who were participating. Now, if I'm the one who's offering, you know, my barn or whatever, there are a couple ways in which those being sheltered are strange to me. Probably, obviously, they're literally strangers. I never met these people before. I have no idea who they are. All I know about them is that they're in need of safety. They're in need of refuge. Often, they were also strangers because the life from which they came, slavery, was outside their host's experience. Right? Some of them had been slaves. Some of them had some experience of slavery, people like the Grimke sisters who came from a slave-owning family. But many others had no experience of slavery. So these were unknown individuals who came from an unknown world. And yet, out of conviction about what was right, people opened their homes. Now, and of course, the physical benefits to the guest are very obvious, right? That's so obvious. What's less clear to us and harder to discern at this chronological remove, however, is what was the effect on the host? If I've argued that hospitality is always this dynamic, changing relationship, here are some observations that I think are probably safe enough. First of all, before the host could provide welcome and refuge, they had to disassociate themselves from slaveholders ideologically. They had to read the Bible differently from the people who were reading it to justify slavery, so that there was some letting go, perhaps, disassociation from other people. Since what they were doing was illegal, they also had to face the potential consequences that what they were doing could transform a person with alien ideas into a criminal. Okay? It's one thing to have weird ideas. It's another thing to do something illegal. And they had to make that step. They had to be willing to be displaced in a political structure, in a social system that supported or at least allowed slavery. You had to face the possibility that you would be hated. One of my heroines, Lucretia Mott, I don't know that she actually participated in the Underground, yes, she did, participated in the Underground Railroad, a very famous abolitionist, came a very staunch Quaker commercial family. And yet, all kinds of ugly things happened to this little, unassuming woman with 8 children known for her cherry pies and good peas, you know, and liking to nail down carpets. These were things she really liked to do because she was willing to offer refuge to those who needed it. Now, not everyone who hid a runaway slave was caught, and it's of course possible that harboring a fugitive in your barn overnight didn't change you at all. That's the possibility. But there was the possibility that you would be changed by it. That, for example, you would go from being opposed to slavery to begin to see the even deeper problems of racism. And Lucretia Mott actually was one who did begin to see that when she moved out in what was then the suburbs of Philadelphia. Now it's still kind of inner city Philadelphia. The horse cart wouldn't take black passengers, and so she walked. This is in the 1870s. I mean, this is a long time before the civil rights movement, so sometimes that will happen. The second example I want to point you to are the Righteous Gentiles of World War II. And maybe this story is less well known to us. It certainly wasn't something I learned in elementary school like I did learn about the Underground Railroad. So briefly to say, these were people in Europe who harbored Jews and wouldn't give them up to the Nazis. There's, of course, the dramatic case of the Danes who were led by their king, and they all put those yellow stars on, so you couldn't tell one Jew from another. Now, we wouldn't necessarily think of that as hospitality. You didn't come into my house. I didn't feed you. And yet, if it is this transformation of host and guest, this changing of vulnerability and safety, imagine what that would do to you. This is not a little junior high game where the people with blue eyes always get to go in line first, just today. This is a real thing. You put on that yellow star and wear it day after day. I think it had to change how they saw the world. The less dramatic case, of course, has become known to us recently because of the documentary, The Weapons of the Spirit, about the little town of La Chambonne, France, where primarily French Huguenots, who were Protestants, sheltered about 5,000 Jews over a period of 4 years. Now, I think there's a lot to be learned from these people's courageous hospitality. I want to say two things. First of all, they were Protestants in a Roman Catholic country. That they themselves had a sense of their own vulnerability as a religious minority. And that shows up in the interviews that this filmmaker who made The Weapons of the Spirit portrays to us. He actually had been a child in that village. These people knew that they were vulnerable. They weren't the people who were the most secure in occupied France. They were actually people who were a little vulnerable, who knew that their security didn't belong to them. And secondly, I think we have to remark on their own view that their actions were unremarkable. When asked why they did it, they just say, well, I couldn't do anything else, you know, sort of bemused. Why would you ask? It needed to be done. This, interestingly, is very characteristic of people involved in a whole set of recent psychological studies of people called moral exemplars. Almost without exception, when asked, well, how did you get, you know, why did you do whatever it was, participate in the civil rights movement or whatever, they just say, well, I didn't have a choice. It was the right thing to do. Luther quotes the Gospels about a good tree bears good fruit. And that's, again, why I think this metaphor is so wonderful of the tree of life. The good tree cannot not bear good fruit. It just happens. So when we think about the fruit of hospitality, it becomes not a choice. It's not a choice to welcome people because what it means to live under the tree. There are no doors under the tree, right? There are no locks. It's just under the tree. Well, it's raining. Come under the tree, right? So then we're near the end. I want to then just say three things that I think are really important if we are going to have this. First, you have to have hosts with authenticity, that we know that we have received, that we give out of having received. It's a way of thinking and doing. Secondly, you have to have guests whose strangeness can become a gift, right? You have to be open to the possibility that the gift isn't what you expected. It's not one of those nice little hostess gifts you can pick up in the airport gift shop. We all know how to recognize those. And not that we don't appreciate a box of See's candy or a bottle of wine or flowers, but that's probably not the gift that comes in genuine hospitality. It's something unexpected. And then thirdly, I do think that duration is important, that we are changed by hospitality more over time than we are in transitory, short-term experiences without ruling that out. So you're very patient in an awkward situation, and because of that, I just sort of threw it all at you. But I hope that the conversation doesn't necessarily need to stop here, and that you will think about it and talk with each other or others or me about hospitality in the days to come. So thank you.
Thank you.